You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you in part by Santa Fe County. If you've been looking to go solar in your home, Santa Fe County's Sustainability Office wants you to know that the 30% federal tax incentives are only available until the end of 2019. So if you've been thinking about going solar, now's the time to do it. And if you're not sure where to start with Santa Fe County's Office of Sustainability, where you can get a free impartial consultation to help demystify the process and help you calculate up front just how big a system you might need. Contact them at 992-9832 or visit santafecountynm.gov/publicworks. And the Radio Cafe is also brought to you by Morningstar Senior Living, which is building its newest community on Pacheco Street in Santa Fe. They'll be providing independent living, assisted living, and memory care to make sure that you and your loved ones can live fully and vibrantly in a safe environment. You can reach Morningstar Senior Living at 505-919-7989. That's 505-919-7989, or go to morningstarseniorliving.com and let them know that you heard about it on the Radio Cafe. And by the way, if you'd like to sponsor the Radio Cafe, please contact Henry Lopez. His email is hlopez@sfnewmexican.com. You can reach him at 505-986-3054, or you can go to radiocafe.org and click on New Mexican, and all that info is there. And now to our program. I'm very happy to welcome Delaina Studi. She's an actress and writer, and she's bringing her one-woman show to the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. It's called And So We Walked, An Artist's Journey Along the Trail of Tears. It's there for one night only, Wednesday, May 23rd, right here in Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this performance is based on your exploration of your Cherokee ancestry, and you walked the Trail of Tears with your father. How did you decide to do this? How did all this come into being?
Well, it's something I've always wanted to do. No one in my family talked about where we lived before the Trail of Tears, and I always wanted to retrace my family's footsteps, but I had to find out where we started from. So, this is something I've been dreaming about ever since I was a little girl, but it started coming into place about 8 years ago when I was working at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. That's when I realized it could actually happen. And then 5 years ago, I met this producer named Corey Madden, and she's actually the director for my piece. And I told her about my dream about walking the Trail of Tears and writing about it and how my father would go along with me. And she said, well, good luck with that. And then I think 3 months later, she got this job in North Carolina, and they gave her a discretionary fund to fund a project about North Carolina. So she called me and asked if I would like to research my family's genealogy to see if we actually had connections to North Carolina, and we did. And so we were able to do the piece that way.
Very interesting. Now, you found out about something called the U.S. Army Survey of Cherokee Lands. What was that, and what did it tell you about your family?
Oh, my goodness. So the U.S. Army surveyed Cherokee lands 20 years before the first removal in June of 1838. And what they were these hand-drawn charts. They were hand-drawn maps of the property. And then they had these charts that had the family's name, how many women were under 16, over 16. And it was as intricate as how many trees they had in their orchards and what kinds. But then there was an appraisal number at the bottom. It was a monetary amount. And I remember asking the director of education at the Museum of the Cherokee Indian, Barbara Duncan, about it. And she said that was the property's appraisal. And then I asked who did the surveys, and that's when she told me it was the U.S. Army. So when I was looking at the chart, I didn't know it was done by the government. I was just like, oh, this is fascinating. And then when you find out the timeline that it was done 20 years before the removal, it lets you know that the removal was already in process before the Treaty of New Echota was signed. It was something it was premeditated, which was very disturbing to me. And what was interesting about it is, you know, she said, you know, maybe we'll find a map of your family's property in here. And I just grabbed a random binder off a shelf, and there were hundreds of them, and they all looked the same. And I just opened this book, and it was a detailed itemization of someone's home. And then I found out that this archaeologist named Brett Briggs had done excavations on two households in the southwestern part of the state. And by the grace of God, divine intervention, synchronicity, whatever you want to call it, the binder I had grabbed happened to be one of those homesteads that were excavated, and it happened to belong to one of my family members. The name of the homestead was Christie, which was my grandmother's maiden name. So in a sheer, you know, stroke of luck, the one binder I find happens to be my family's homestead, and it's much more than just that detailed chart. It's actually an excavation of what they found on the site of where the house used to be.
I mean, what are the chances of that? First of all, that you would, of the hundreds of binders, that you would grab that one, and then of the very few excavations, presumably, that were done, that your family's house would be among them.
Oh, that's how this trip has worked for me. I know this is going to sound really bizarre, but this whole project has been about those moments of sheer luck or those, you know, divine grace driving me and guiding me. And so many things fell into place to make this piece happen. And I'm learning to be open to it. And what's fascinating about this whole project is it wants to be bigger than what I intended it to be. So when I first wrote the project, it had nothing to do with me and my father. It was about the people we met along the way. But my director, Corey, kept pushing me to make it more personal and to tell the story about walking the trail with my dad and what was that like. And then, of course, she just kept me going deeper and deeper. And I discovered the more specific I become, the more universal the story is. And so I have people here in Portland, I'm actually at Portland Center Stage right now doing my piece here, who aren't Native, but hear the story and they can relate to it. And it's opening doors. It's really quite amazing because now, because of this, I'm able to go to Santa Fe. Because of Santa Fe, we're in the process of setting up a tour in the Northeast. Because of the success of this show, we're talking about creating an audiobook. And so all these little magical doors are happening, and I just have to be open to it. But this whole project has been about those little moments where sheer luck takes over, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, it does. I mean, we all know, or many of us know, that feeling of synchronicity when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, or when you're doing something that really has some life to it, your path is somehow magically cleared. You experienced that. And that was only one of many examples of that, the thing of finding the information on your family. And it was quite shocking information. What did you find out about your family?
Well, I found out my family was in the top 3% of wealth of North Carolina at the time. And that was interesting to hear because after the removal, you know, we had to start from nothing. We had to rebuild ourselves and reestablish our sovereign nation. And a lot of our people still live in Cherokee homes that are reservation style homes. I wouldn't say we're poor, but we were certainly not in the top 3% of wealth in my small town. And I think the most disturbing thing I found out was that my family owned slaves. And that was very hard for me to come to terms with. I'm still kind of processing and working that out. But it was a whole different lifestyle. And so I'm trying to, you know, reconcile that my Cherokee ancestors were both victims and victimizers. It was just fascinating to see how much we lost. And I always wonder where we would be if the removal hadn't have happened.
It's such a crazy thing to have to come to terms with. I mean, your ancestors were slave owners and they were Cherokees, and you have to wonder what that relationship was like. And then they themselves were removed from their own land, from all their own property. And some of that property, if I understood the play correctly, ended up underwater because they built a dam. Is that correct?
That is correct. Our old homestead is underwater because of a government dam. Although there are certain times of the year when the water recedes and you can see the rooftop and you can see some of the structure that's still standing. And so that was hard to understand as well, because it's like, I finally found our old home place and I go there. Once again, because of the government, I can't go there.
Right.
And I learned that my family was held as prisoners at Fort Butler, and I was able to find their names on the roster of Cherokee prisoners at Fort Butler. And that was also hard to hear because there were these internment camps that were set up before the removal. I wasn't able to visit Fort Butler, but I was able to see in a museum the remnants of Fort Butler and also the documents from Fort Butler, and to find my family's name there and to know that they were treated like prisoners of war. I still have moments of trying to understand all that. When I was on the trail with my father, I would find this information and I would become so enraged and embittered. But my father, on the other hand, he found life out of the trail. For some reason, taking him back home and letting him see the old sacred sites that he never thought he'd get to see with his own eyes, and then to walk in his family's footsteps, it made my father come alive. And my father saw it as, these are our people. These are the reasons why we are here. And we should celebrate that survival and the fact that we are still here. Whereas I was becoming so bogged down with the history that I was having a hard time seeing it from his point of view.
Very interesting. And it's important, I think, to talk about both sides of that, because, I mean, you talk about a little bit in the play about Andrew Jackson, who was one of the cruelest people we've ever had, certainly among presidents, toward Native people, toward Indigenous people in this country. And there was a huge and tragic irony, which was a very pro-Native Supreme Court decision came down, and then Andrew Jackson said, great, but we're not going to enforce it.
Yes. And that Supreme Court decision is actually one of the founding principles of our tribal sovereignty today. And so it should have protected us. But President Jackson, I believe his quote was, well, then let the Supreme Court's army enforce it because the president's army is going to make the Cherokee move. Yeah. And so he purposely disregarded that. He didn't enforce it. He disregarded it. And because of that reason, we were removed. It's just so shocking to me that no one was upset by this. You know, I would like to think that if that were to happen in today's age, if a president disregarded a Supreme Court decision, that our people would be up in arms. They would be fighting that. They would be trying to find a way to uphold that because that's unjust. But yet, back then, people were willing to turn a blind eye. For me, it's very frightening. The more I learn about it, the more the angrier I become. And so I'm learning to try not to judge history with today's lens. But it's been very trying.
Yeah. Now, you couldn't walk the whole 900 miles because some of that is freeway, but how long were you on the road walking? What was it like? What did you do along the way?
Well, you know, my big joke was I'm taking my father with me, who was not yet 70 at the time. And so I didn't want it to be a reenactment. I wanted to make sure my whole team made it home safe. Right. And so we would walk as much as my father could. So sometimes that would be up to 4 hours. Sometimes it'd be up to 6 hours. If it's a hot day, we'd be like 2 hours, but we'd walk as much as the trail as we could. And some of it's now freeway and some of it's private property. And we were very lucky that in some of the states that we passed through, the owners of the private property would give us private tours. So we traveled the trail in different ways. We walked it. We rode in the back of someone's pickup truck once. And of course, you know, we traveled as much as we could on foot if it was possible. But there were some places where the wagon ruts were still there and we could see where they had passed through. They were perfectly preserved. And for me, that was amazing, just being able to put our hands down where the wagons had gone through. I know that meant a lot for my father as well. We were able to travel through some trails where people, you know, if you wouldn't have known that the trail had passed through there, you would just think it was just another trail through the woods, but you'd find these old bridges made out of rock that were still standing. And so we were lucky to have a lot of local historians that would guide us. But depending on the day would determine how far we would walk. We purposely set up checkpoints and we had someone that was driving in a car beside us. So if my father got tired or it was too hot, we could get a ride. But it was important for us to walk as much as we could.
And you also met people and were interviewed and learned stories and all kinds of other things along the way.
Oh, yes. We have probably over 500 hours of footage from the people we met along the way. What's fascinating was when I first started writing the play, you know, I mentioned it had nothing to do with my father or myself. So we don't really have any interviews between my father and me. There are no interviews about us. And so it's really fascinating that we didn't interview ourselves, but we interviewed so many people along the way. And a lot of the play is about those interviews that we had and those chance encounters. And then, of course, the conversations I had with my father that aren't recorded. But my father and I have gone through the script and he's approved everything that I say in the script.
When you were a child, you grew up in Oklahoma and an elementary school teacher told you, you said, I'm Cherokee. And she said, oh, no, dear, Indian people are extinct, which is shocking on a number of levels. I mean, not only because it's ignorant, but because, I mean, that's a term you use for plant and animal species, not for people. So how did your father react to that?
Oh, my goodness. So I changed it a little bit in my script. I changed what grade I was in to protect the teacher because she still is a teacher at my school. And she had good intentions. And that's what they were required to teach. I remember asking that question. They were teaching us about the first Thanksgiving. And I was so excited. I was like, I'm an Indian. And she said, no, you're not, honey. Indians are extinct. But I was such a young child. I didn't know what that word meant. So I was very excited. I thought this was something fancy. I was like, oh, we're special. We're extinct. And I remember going home and like, trying to impress my father with my new word and asking him what extinct meant. And then when he told me, I was devastated. You know, my father's a hard worker. He worked as a machinist in a factory and he would never miss work, not even when he was sick. And the next morning I was surprised that he was having breakfast with me and that he wasn't at work. And he said, you know, we're going to the school today because we have to teach her a lesson. What was fascinating about the story that just blows my mind to this day is he we go into the school, and the teacher is there, and he tells her that we are still here, that we are not extinct. And her first response is, well, my grandmother was Cherokee, but that's what we're required to teach. And my father was just, I remember just seeing his face. He was just so aghast, because if your grandmother is Cherokee, that means you are Cherokee.
Right.
The bloodline didn't end with her. And so my father's remedy was, he begrudgingly ran for the school board and he won, and then he changed the curriculum. And so that was always my father's trick, was you find a way to get into the system and you make the changes from inside. And so that's basically what I've been doing with all of my career. You find a way to get into the system and you make the changes. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the play, honestly, is no one was teaching the history about our people. And there are so many people that don't know about the Trail of Tears. They don't know that that was just one of the many removals. So many different tribal nations had been removed because of the Indian Removal Act and Andrew Jackson, and no one ever talks about that. And so how do we find a way to get the education out there? And so one of the ways you do it is you hide it as entertainment. And people don't realize they're being taught a lesson. They think they're being entertained. And it's really fascinating how that can cut through the walls and bring people's barriers down, and they're more open to hearing it, as opposed if I were to protest or say, do a lecture. And so I find that's my way in. And that's a trait I learned from my father.
Right. I mean, it's really interesting to me because you talk about how very early on your father made you very aware of your Indian identity, your Cherokee identity. Your father was Cherokee. Your mother was of European origin. And it seems like this play, the writing of it, the research, the doing the walk along the Trail of Tears, brought that to a new level. What did you learn about yourself, about Cherokee people, that you didn't already know?
Well, I think the one thing that sticks with me about the trail and doing the research about the trail, and of course going back home to our original homelands in North Carolina, is that for a long time I thought the Trail of Tears defined us as a people. But the truth is, it doesn't. It was a defining moment for our people, but it doesn't define us as a people, because we are still here. We are thriving. We are striving. And so after I did the trail, and after, you know, it's been, we walked the trail in July of 2015. So it's been almost 3 years. I've had some time and distance between it. And I realized that we could take this moment and we can choose to be seen as victims, or we could take this moment and realize that we are resilient and we're survivors. And I now see the Trail of Tears as a story of hope and as resiliency and being able to overcome any hardship that's thrown our way. I find that that gives me strength. And what's fascinating about when I, you know, me before I did the trail, was I really wanted to prove myself as a Cherokee person. I really wanted to prove myself as a strong Cherokee woman, as this warrior woman. And the truth is, that's something that we can't really prove. That's something that we already are, and we just have to trust that it's there.
One of the things I didn't know about the Trail of Tears was that the very name of it is perhaps misunderstood, and that the tears were not necessarily the tears of the Cherokee people walking, but the tears of the essentially oppressors who were so ashamed of what they were doing that they literally wept. Is that true? Do we know that?
I know that the Cherokee word for it means the trail where they cried. And I'm pretty sure, you know, our people cried on the trail just because we were losing so many people. You know, the first ones to go were always the elders and the young ones. And we were traveling during the winter. But the story my father always told me, and it's the story that was passed down to him, was that it was called the trail where they cried because it was the white people who cried, the Yonega, because they saw what they had done and they were ashamed. I don't know if that's true or not, but I know that's the story that was passed down through my father. And that's the story he taught me. And it's one of the things that basically defined my childhood, was knowing that we didn't cry. We didn't give them the luxury of seeing us at our lowest. And so finding that strength, even whenever you feel like you can't go on, we've still found it. And so that was something that helped me get through, you know, my childhood in high school. And then of course, when I moved to Los Angeles, where I was, you know, I didn't know very many Native people, let alone Cherokee, that's what helped me get through a lot of my hardships, was just knowing that it wasn't us, it was them. And that we were a proud people, and we would refuse to let them see us broken or beaten.
We are talking to actress and writer Delana Studi. And we're just going to take a quick break to tell you that the Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. We've had a warm winter with lots of beautiful blue skies, but very little moisture, and the city is calling on its residents to renew our water conservation efforts. You can visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the new online water quiz and learn how to save water and contribute long-term to keeping Santa Fe green and healthy. You'll also find out how to earn hundreds and even thousands of dollars by making your home and workplace more water-wise. Once again, that's facebook.com/savewatersantafe. And now back to our program. Now, you were talking about your identity as a warrior woman, and that is part of what your father taught you. And there is, I mean, it's interesting that part of Cherokee tradition is the separate roles of men and women. Each one is supposed to do a different thing. Women are supposed to have children. And you have walked a different path than that. How do you sort it all out for yourself, both in the context of the play and in your own life?
Oh, very carefully. Sometimes I don't do a great job of sorting it out. You know, that's my joke about the play, is it's all about me failing and not being my best self and still finding ways to dust myself off and get up. You know, one of the things that was really impressed on me when I was on the trail was that we are matrilineal. Our people are matrilineal. The women have the power. The women keep the culture going. And one of the ways you do that is by having and creating future generations. And I haven't had children. So that was a big pressing moment on me. It was like, oh, I'm not fulfilling any of my Cherokee duties, let alone my duties as a woman. And in a lot of cases, I wasn't even referred to as a woman. I was still referred to as girl because I haven't had children. And it was very hard for me to come to terms with that. But because of the path I've chosen, you know, my father helped me see this as the legacy I leave behind doesn't necessarily have to be children. You know, and in a weird way, creating this play was like me creating a child.
Yeah.
I gave birth to something. It was a very painful delivery, let me tell you. And now the child is growing up and the child wants to be something bigger than I anticipated. Because when I first wrote the play, I thought it would go to community houses and tribal schools and maybe colleges and universities. I had no idea it was going to be produced at two major theaters that do not specialize in Native theater. So it's already exceeded my expectations. And so I have to allow this child to grow up and be what it wants to be and kind of sit back and see what happens to it. So I've used this whole child metaphor for my play, but I've released myself from that burden of feeling like that I'm never going to fulfill my role as a Cherokee woman. And it's like, well, what can I do to promote my people? What can I do to bring awareness about who we are? And what can I do to make the future generations aware of what happened? And also, how do I inspire them to keep telling our stories and to tell their own stories?
Right, right. I heard it. I mean, just as an aside, I heard once a story about a fortune teller who told a woman, who was a writer, you're going to have two children, but it might be two books.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, so let's talk about your acting. I mean, you're an actress, theater and film. To what extent are you cast into Native roles versus any other roles? And how are the dynamics of casting changing? Have you seen a shift toward more openness?
I haven't seen it, but I've heard about it.
Uh-huh.
But we're moving towards there. Unfortunately, you know, for me, most of the roles I get cast in are Native roles. I hardly get an audition for a non-Native role. I was cast in a sci-fi TV series where I played a nondescript woman, but her name was Cheyenne. So I'm not sure if she was Native or not, you know, so it's,
right.
I have these moments where I'm like, I could technically justify that as a non-Native role, but at the same time, her name is very identifiably Native. I would love to be able to see our people just be human beings, right? And I think that's always a goal of any actor that's considered, you know, part of the minority, is you get typecast as what they see you as. You get typecast as what you were in the past, and eventually you'll be seen as the president of the United States or an attorney or a doctor. But we're not quite there yet, unless, of course, it's a Native TV series or a Native movie where it's a Native person as a doctor, but they're still Native. And so I would like to see our people just be. I think that's a step in the right direction, because I feel America likes to put us in the past, and they like to think of us as some exotic creature behind museum glass. And the truth is, we are beautifully flawed people, and we have such beautifully complex storylines, and we're so beautifully diverse that we need to capture that, because it's part of our shared American history, and it's a part of the American scene, and it's not being reflected on television or film. I do feel we're making strides. I have a friend that's working at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and he's not cast as a native. In fact, the two plays he's doing up there, he's not a native character at all. And to me, that's a step in the right direction. You know, our actor should be able to play, Hamlet, and not have it be a native Hamlet, just be Hamlet.
Right.
We're capable of saying the words. And so I think that's a good step in the right direction.
Now, do you act in Shakespeare plays?
I do when I can. but once again, I'm usually afforded a Shakespearean role whenever it has a native theme. So I worked at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and I had a wonderful time. We did a Romeo and Juliet, but it took place in 1830s California. So it was right before California became a state. And there was also a bounty on Native American scalps because that was one of the first laws that California issued. So I played an Ohlone apothecary, but I doubled as some other characters, but I did play the Ohlone apothecary. And I actually have a friend of mine who was Ohlone who came to see the show, and she wrote a review about it. And apparently the review was all about my character because they got everything right. At least they took the time to get to tell the story. And of course, if you learn the apothecary's lines and they talk about how there's a bounty on their head and, by selling the poison, they're signing their own death warrant. It really rings true when you know the history of California at the time. So I've been able to do some Shakespeare, but it's just by sheer luck sometimes. Like I was able to go on opening night at Oregon Shakespeare Festival for Henry IV Part II as Lady Percy. And I don't think I would have ever been able to audition for that part, but at least I got to go on opening night as that character.
I heard somebody, and I can't for the life of me remember who it was, but it was some Hollywood person who said, here's the rule of thumb to adopt. When you have a character that does not absolutely have to be male, like it's a detective or whatever, make it a female. And if you have a person who doesn't absolutely, by the nature of the role, have to be white, cast a person of color. And I think if you start to think that way, it opens your mind to a whole range of just interesting dynamics, both of casting and then of how the piece itself will unfold, whether it's a TV show or a movie or whatever.
That's so true. One of the problems that we're encountering, though, is when casting directors think of any ethnicity, we fall through the cracks. People don't think of us. They think of every other ethnicity, but they don't really think of Native Americans. And so I have, brilliant friends who are casting directors and playwrights and directors who aren't Native who have asked me, but where do we find the Native talent? And it's just so shocking to me because we have so many talented Native actors, writers, producers, directors out there, but yet they don't think of us. And then when they do think of us, it's like, oh, but it's like trying to catch a unicorn. How do we find them? It's very disturbing to me that I get that question all the time. And then they're shocked when I start naming off names like, oh, what age range do you want? Do you want male or female? Do you want trans? I got the names. You tell me what you want and I can give you the names. And so they're always just shocked by the list of Native talent I can rattle off because they don't know where to look or they don't know how to look, to be honest. But once again, whenever they think of people of color, they don't think of Native Americans, and we got to change that perspective. We got to be able to be seen. And so that's what we're trying to do.
Let's go back to the play. It's called And So We Walked, An Artist's Journey Along the Trail of Tears. I read this. I mean, I haven't seen it yet. I read the play on paper, and I felt in many ways that it was a love letter to your father. How did he respond to it? How did it affect him?
Oh, my goodness. So it is basically a love letter to my father. My father, my father always told me that Cherokee people believe you choose your parents. And once again, I never researched that because I don't want to disprove it because I kind of like the idea that I had that power and I chose my parents. And I always joke that I may never win a lottery, but I won the parent lottery.
Right.
I was blessed with some really wonderful parents. And you don't hear a lot about my mother in the play because she asked me not to put her in it. Actually, she threatened me that if I put her in it, she would cause me bodily harm. So I don't have my mom in the play. I mean, she makes an appearance. But everything I do with the play has been approved through my parents. My parents live in Oklahoma. They don't have internet. They don't have cable. So whenever I do a rewrite, I would call them on the phone. They'd put me on speaker and then I'd read it to them and then they would give me notes or they'd sign off on it or say, no, we don't think you should say that. And so everything in the play has been pre-approved by them. And my father has forced me to go deeper as well. Like, there's a fight with my father in the play, and I wasn't going to tell all of our dirty secrets, you know. And my father was like, well, did you say this one line? And I said, no. And he's like, but that's the point of the play. That's the reason why we had that fight. You need to say it. And so my father made me like say something that I didn't want to share, but I said it anyway, because out of service to him. When he first saw the play, a lot of our Cherokee people, I think it's true of Native people in general. They're taught to be humble. You're not supposed to brag about yourself or actively seek out compliments. My father is not one to compliment people. And so my director, who is not Native, was very interested in what my father had to say, because my father's he's a very big man. He's like 6'3", about 250, big guy. He's also very silent. And until you get to know him, he doesn't say a lot. After the performance in North Carolina, my director, Corey Madden, said, well, Mr. Studi, why did you think of the play? And my father said, I didn't fall asleep once. Which, if you know my father, that's the highest compliment you could receive. And though since then, I was talking about the show out here, because he was asking me how the show's doing. And I said, well, it's really bizarre because it's selling out. We've had sold out shows every time I've done the show here. I've done the performance, I think, 48 times now, and we've had a full house. And we have a lot of students that come to the student matinees. In fact, they added more matinees for me. So I was doing added shows each week in addition to my normal 8 shows. And so it was really quite wonderful. And so I was telling my father this, and he's like, well, it's good that people see it because it's a good show. And I was like, thanks, Pop. So my father is very happy with the show, and I finally got a compliment that's more than I didn't fall asleep once. And so that was a big deal for me. But it was, you know, it was a very big deal for me to take my father on the trip as well, because, you know, he's a boarding school survivor and so much has been taken from him. And yet he's been able to retain so much of his identity and culture that I wanted to give something back to him. I wanted to take him back to where we came from.
And how did your mother respond to it?
Oh, my mother, she loves it. I mean, she thinks it's amazing. My mom is my first reader. In fact, my love of reading came from my mother. And so anytime I write anything, I send it to my mom first, and she gives me the best notes and I incorporate them. And I told her, you know, one of the biggest questions I always get in our talkbacks is people are always asking about your mom, and they always assume that I don't have a good relationship with my mother because she's barely in the play. And I always try to, you know, before they even get the question now, I say, I know people are going to ask about my mom. She requested not to be in a play, which is why she's not in it as often. And she's read and given me notes on every single page that you've heard today. So my mother has been probably my most active cheerleader, even though you don't hear a lot about her in the play.
Right, right. Very interesting. You know, what you said a moment ago, one of the things that I am really interested in is cultural differences. And what are the more profound cultural differences, and how does it affect one's life when you have to live in a culture that's not your own? And I think the humility part of it is really huge, because humility is something that's taught by many cultures, including Christianity. But in American culture, you are expected to be continually self-promoting yourself, which some people find very difficult to do, and some people are explicitly taught not to do. So it's a real conflict that I imagine you have to deal with to some extent as well, because as the writer and actor in a one-woman show, there you are having to put yourself out there all the time and promote yourself.
Oh, goodness. The self-promotion is I'm so terrible at that. In fact, it took my director, Corey Madden, and her team at the Keenan Institute of the Arts to create a website for me, because I don't have a website. I've been trying to create my own website for 3 years, and I just can't do it, just because it's just uncomfortable for me to talk about myself in that way. So it took Corey and the Keenan Institute to create a website for And So We Walked. And the only way that happened is it's not about me, it's about the project. You know, people always think, oh, it's a solo performance, but the truth is, yes, it's only that one actor on the stage, but if you knew how many people took to get that one person on that stage, and how many people were working behind the scenes, and how many designers have shaped the show into what it is, we're talking, you know, and also developing the show and going out into the community. I would not be here doing what I do if it wasn't for a cast and crew of thousands of people. And then, of course, you know, the audience is an extra actor on the stage in a weird way, because I feed off of what they have. So
I'm very terrible at the self-promoting. And so I've been very lucky that the people who have done the show, like Triad Stage and Portland Center Stage, and of course, the Keenan Institute, and the people that helped develop it, like Native Voices and Trinity Rep and Brown University and the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program, that they helped promote it, because otherwise no one would know about the show. But and of course, right now, you know, I'm very lucky because I'm coming to Santa Fe and because I'm working with this amazing production company, Silver Bullet, for their fundraiser, that they are actually helping promote it as well. I always joke that whenever I do a project, I'm like a vampire. I don't really come unless I'm invited. And and one of the ways that this whole project has kind of come into being is through word of mouth, through I call it the Underground Women's Network. So it's all these women who hear about what I'm doing. And I say, oh, you know, that you, I would really love to talk to this elder. And the next thing I know, they've set up a meeting. Or I'm going to be passing through Alabama, and the next thing I know, I'm doing a town hall speech for the Trail of Tears Association of Alabama. And so that's how it's all through these other amazing people who believe in my show and champion my show and see it for what it can be. You know, it's entertaining. It's also educational, and they go out of their way to help me. I've been very lucky that that's how my publicity has happened. But if, because it was up to me, I probably wouldn't do much. No one would ever know where the show is because it's so uncomfortable for me.
Right, right. Delano Studi is an actress and writer. The show is called And So We Walked, An Artist's Journey Along the Trail of Tears. It's at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center for one night only, Wednesday, May 23rd. Delano, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.